accession number 23821 Reel 2. Okay. Mr. Halliday, Reel 2. We're talking about when you went to the RAF recruiting centre in Croydon in 1943 on a Wednesday afternoon.
Well, yeah, and I was disappointed when I got there to find it was closed. And apparently, in those days, and it's, as it is still the same today in the RAF, that Wednesday afternoon is their sports afternoon. I don't know what happened with the Battle of Britain pilots, whether they took Wednesday afternoon off. But I'd had half a day off from work and could ill afford it for no, if I wasn't going to gain anything from it. Outside the recruiting office was the usual posters of other services. And I saw the one about the Navy, so I hopped onto a bus and went to Carshalton. Their recruiting centre was open. I can remember that outside was a Marine sergeant, fully dressed up. And he said, "Hello, lad, have you come to join the Marines?" And I took one look at him, and he was 12 foot tall, and said, "No, thank you." I went inside and, believe it or not, the Navy were rather choosy because you had to sit an intelligence test, which was pretty elementary. And once I got through that, I was given a quick sort of medical. And said, right, they would accept me, but they would be in touch.
Now, do you know when this was? I know it's 1943, but any idea of the month, winter, or season?
Oh, I think this would be somewhere around about, January.
43.
Yeah. That's right, yeah. And some 4 weeks later, received a telegram and telegrams were unusual in those days, but this one contained at least 50 words telling me that would I contact them, I'd been accepted, but if I did not do so within 24 hours then they would scratch us off. And a telephone number. I responded, and in 2 days I got through the post a travel warrant to travel up to Sheerness.
I just want to make clear, I miscalculated, because you'd have been, in January, it must have been 44, that's my fault.
I'm 17.
Yeah.
And, wait a minute, I always get mixed up. Did I get Nessie's up by the wash, isn't it?
Lincolnshire, yes.
Yeah. So the travel warrant was to travel to Skegness. Was only there 24 hours.
What, at Skegness?
Skegness for kitting up.
Now, what happened when you got to Skegness?
Well, in actual fact, I mean, it seemed a complete farce because you arrived there and was kitted up, new uniform, and that kit laid down for the night, and the following morning, in actual fact, we were entrained for Ganges.
Now, what do you remember of the kitting out? What did they give you? Or do you not remember? What sort of stuff did they give you?
Oh, it was full uniform, underclothes, and also a case, overcoat. They didn't give you any personal things like No, it was just clothes, underclothes, socks, boots, shoes. No, that was the extent of it.
And this would be round about February 44.
Yeah.
And then you went to Ganges, HMS Ganges.
Then we went to HMS Ganges.
That was the shore station.
That's the shore station at Shotley near Ipswich. Where we did our basic training.
Now, how were you received when you got to Shotley? Because, you know, you're arriving as a civilian. You've been kitted out, sure enough. But how did they sort of take you in, you know, those first days? Do you remember how they received you?
It wasn't... Actually, the reception was quite good, really. After all, they'd been doing this for the past 3 years, or much longer, I suppose, because before the war, it was also a training establishment. But I was allocated a mess, which was a large hall, immaculately clean.
Hall or a hut, sorry.
A hut, if you like, yeah. Immaculately clean. The floor was wooden, and it shone like the blazes. You could see your face in it. There were the beds. There was double-decker beds, but they were iron bedsteads.
Either side of the hut.
One up, one down. Yeah, on either side, yeah. Quite comfortable. And
heating?
Yes, the heating range was quite good. The food was good. Plenty of it.
If we look at a sort of typical day's training, we might pick up a few of the things. I mean, about what time would your day start at Ganges? Approximately.
I don't know, to be quite honest, I can't remember. I would think somewhere around about 8 o'clock, about 7, 8 o'clock. That would be time for breakfast. And then immediately after that, of course, it was a case of splitting up into various smaller groups for various types of training.
Maybe. Let's go through some of the sessions. Would you do drill?
We would do field drill. With a rifle.
What did you think of drill, and how did you take to it?
I didn't think much, really, of the field drill. I was more interested, in actual fact, in the other aspects. Particularly, I had a bent for guns and machinery. I really looked forward to the lessons with the old chief gunner's mate on varying types of guns.
And what sort of guns were they introducing you to at that stage?
At that stage, they did show you, of course, started off with a rifle, and how you took it to pieces and reassembled it. But then we went on to both as pom-poms and Erlikons. Then there was some larger guns, the quarter gunners, as we called them, which I must confess, I wasn't too interested in them.
Your interest was the sort of the light guns?
I was really, really in for the light guns, because I was fascinated, I suppose, it was this business about feeling I had about aeroplanes. I had a wonderful memory when it came to, or ability to, aircraft recognition, and indeed on my training report I got 100% for it, and so from that point of view, I suppose that led to, if you like, the light anti-aircraft sort of type of gun.
Which were your favourite? What did you think of the three you mentioned? There's the pom-pom, the Erlikon, and the Bofors. What did you think of each of them?
Well, it didn't matter, really. I mean, the point is, though, that, you know, if indeed you... Because what happened there was that at the end of the training, dependent upon how well you had done at various aspects of the training, then of course you it was recommended that you went in for a particular type of gunnery. Both as pom-poms and Oerlikons, they all come within the same category.
Did you have at the early stage any preference?
I fell in love with an Oerlikon, to be quite frank.
What was better about the Oerlikon than the Bofors or the pom-pom?
The Oerlikon, of course, in those days, we're talking about a single Oerlikon, was one person in control of it. Where on a Bofa or a pom-pom, then you've got a crew of two or maybe three. But with an Oerlikon, it was your gun. You was the other part of the gun. And
that's what you particularly like, being in control.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. I've always liked to be master of my own destiny, really, I suppose. But I couldn't, I turned down big guns straight away because I couldn't envisage myself being what they would call a quarter gun rating, and you may end up down below deck loading the shells up. I wanted to be upon the upper deck. If that would add in an element of preservation, I don't know. It may have had.
There's different dangers.
Well, the point was that if anything's going to happen to the ship, I'd rather be on top than stuck down below.
Did you actually get a chance to fire the guns at this stage, or were you just learning the basic mechanisms?
Not the Oerlikons. We fired the rifles. And my record showed that I wasn't very clever at them. The marking was very, very low.
We'll come back because, you know, obviously you go on to do courses in the anti-aircraft. What about other? What about PT? I mean,
yes, you did.
How fit were you? And did the PT you did improve your condition? Or?
Oh, there's no doubt about it that when you arrived at Ganges, was far from fit. In fact, probably carrying somewhere around about 2 stone more than I should have been. But that seemed to be par for the course with most of the lads that came in with me. And the PT was pretty good.
What sort of things were you doing?
Oh, it would be usual business of what do they call it? You know, this hands
and exercises.
And of course, you had an opportunity there, which I did take, and that did prove that I had my fitness had improved, and that was to go up the mast at Ganges. And that's a pretty high mast.
It is high, that's right.
And I did go up it, right up to the top, and thoroughly enjoyed it.
You weren't scared of heights then?
No.
Did you go out the proper way, or did you go through the hole? You know, because you can go out via the rigging, or...
No, you went outside to do it properly. In actual fact, there was the... Paddy officer down below, balling his head off and making sure you did it right. The other thing that I enjoyed was swimming.
Could you swim before you went?
Yeah. As a youngster, we used to go down when I was about 5 or 6, so I was taken down to Battersea swimming baths, and two of my older brothers just threw me in at the deep end, and that was the way you learned to swim. One interesting point about that during that training was that before you could qualify for any shore leave, as we would call it, which only amounted to something like 2 hours, you had to swim the length of the baths in a what was called a duck suit, which is a it's a heavy canvas suit. But I didn't find any problem with this whatsoever. That was a piece of cake. Then a case. The other thing I liked doing was knots and splicing. I could.
People don't know much about that. Even now, they don't know much about knots and splices. Mm. I mean, what was the point of it? Why did you do so much of it? Because they did quite a bit of it in the Navy.
Yeah, I suppose really a lot of it is historical, isn't it? Because I mean, when they had wooden ships, and that then the point is that all these knots were relevant, but they're not today. Certain basic sort of knots, like a bowline on the bight. That's an important one to know, because very often somebody's in the water and you want to pull them out. And if they put the rope around them, unless you've got the right knot, which is the bowline on the bight, in pulling them up, you could strangle them. But so it was useful in that sense, but also splicing was important as well.
Is this splicing ropes or wires?
Wires, I've done both. Although mostly ropes, because most of the wires were spliced ashore in the docks. But you would come across, and later on I came into this, which I'll come to a bit later on.
How did you actually do it? It's all splicing ropes. It always seems quite difficult.
No, well, I mean, it depends upon the type of the size of the rope, really. I mean, obviously, if you've got a heavy one, then you need a marlin spike to get in and with the different cords and that. It's pretty heavy on the old fingers. But once you've learnt it, it's fascinating, really, that when you've completed it and you have a look at it, you say, bloody good job, that. Or, well, I could have done better. I think you developed a feeling of pride in your own work.
Now, what about other aspects of seamanship? How far did you go into seamanship generally, you know? General seamanship. Did you do sort of boxing and compass, things like that? Or
no. In actual fact, when we've got to really sort of leave the Ganges and start going on a ship, because that's when your seamanship really is put into practice. I mean, what happens in a training establishment to... It's quite different from what happens when you're actually at sea. But
so not much seamanship as far as you remember?
No.
Cutter work?
No. No, as I say, the thing is that I think it depended to a certain extent on this training as to where you were allocated.
Just keep going through. What about your meals? We pick up on the food. You mentioned food earlier. What was the food like there? You know...
Well, I had no...
Compared to what you were used to.
Let's be honest about it. The point is, though, that it was a better food than what I was receiving at home. It was... there was plenty of it, and bags of meat and things of that kind, which, of course, was in short supply because of rationing for the civilians. And, no, there was... No complaint at all as far as food was concerned. In fact, really, I mean, you know, the impression that one had there was, well, you'd been taken into a sort of cloistered environment where you was clothed, you was fed, you was actually paid for it. All right, it was only three bob a day. But, you didn't have a worry in the world.
You'd have these training sessions morning and afternoon. And then what would you do in the evening?
There was nothing to do in the evening there, because I said that you couldn't even go ashore until, in actual fact, towards the tail end of the time at Ganges, which was only 7 weeks, six, 7 weeks, something like that. They'd been cut considerably during the war. I mean, before the war, I understand that new entrants would do their basic training and it'd last over 12 months. And indeed, I think that happened, was the same after the war, but of course during the wartime it was a...
Did they teach you to prepare for kit inspections, you know, to smart... I mean, was there a lot of bull about the place?
No. You was expected, in actual fact, to keep where you was tidy. There was rounds, rounds were certainly taken every day. The officer would come through with the officer of the day with the couple of paddy officers in tow and inspect the quarters. And but there was no bull about, you know, you've got to have your boots stuck in the right place at the right angle, or your toothbrush pointing to starboard or port, and nothing like that. It was, you see, the thing is, though, that one must remember that this was a wartime environment. There wasn't time, quite frankly, for bullshit. The important point was that you was there to get through the training as quickly as possible and then get out on the job. So
just a couple, how did you get on with your fellow recruits? Were they from the same sort of background yourself? Did you make any friends?
No, they were quite a mixture, actually. But I can always remember one, we had one chap in there, and his name was Elf Dietz. And he had actually been, what was it? He was a boxer. I think he was ex-police, or admitted police force, and was the London heavyweight champion. Elf would like to put his gloves on and do a bit of danced about to keep yourself fit. And he would ask in some of us to put the gloves on and approach me, and I said, no, I'm not interested. But he kept on and kept on, and he said, I won't hit you, I won't touch you. So I can remember I did put the gloves on, and he landed one on the side of my ruddy head. God alive. Well, the part of London that I was brought up in, you didn't take things lying down. And I mentioned earlier that the floor of this hut was made of wood and highly polished. And we had those sort of bumpers. It was a rocker on the bottom of a pole, which you polished the floor with. And Elf hit me on the side of the head. And I can remember throwing the gloves off, running to this bumper, picking it up, and chasing him out the bloody room. Because quite honestly, I would have brained him, even though he was a boxer. But I can remember that vividly. That he never asked me again.
Did you get on with most of them?
But I mean, we... And it was strange, really, because during our course, we had our own class, but we was doing our training with some CW candidates. And they were all Anzacs. They were either New Zealand or Australians.
These are people being marked for possible commission.
Yeah. Most of them had been elder commission in the army, either in New Zealand army or the Australian army. But of course, at that time, the threat of a Japanese invasion to Australia had diminished, and so some of them opted to come over and join the Navy. As I say, we did our training, part of our training with them. I can remember one instance of the field training, and there was one of these lads, he was a New Zealander, And he was pretty good with his fist, by the way. He's a good boxer. And I did have a go in the ring with him. But the point is, though, that they soon decided to stop it. Not in my favour, but in his favour. The other way around. And I was the one that was getting a wallop in. it was a strange incident, really, because we were fell in, and because these were CW candidates, this chap in particular was sort of, he was given the privilege of presenting the company to the officer. And we was all lined up there with our rifles. And anyhow, he goes marching off to the officer to say that the parade was correct. And he's got his gun rifled there. And when he arrived there, he saluted like this, which of course, with his right hand coming up, which of course is quite incorrect. I mean, what he should have done was brought his hand over to the rifle, which is a salute, if you've got a gun. Which, of course, we... and there was a little bit of rivalry between, if you like, us and the CW candidates, because they were all going to be officers. There was a little bit of sniggering and a few ribald remarks at the time, like, but... just a little aside that you sort of remember from those times.
There's no bullying, though?
No. No. No, it was...
Did you make many good pals? Or was it not long enough, 6 weeks?
It's a short period, really. I mean, there was one lad who... chap by the name of Norman Keats. I'll refer to Norman later on, if you like. We did our training together. He was a quiet lad, though. He didn't really come out. He didn't smoke. He didn't drink. But he was a nice lad.
Now, what about the instructors? How did you get on with them?
They were all right. And in fact, I can picture him today. I can still see this chief petty officer gunner's mate. They must have brought him out of the woodwork from retirement to for the war. But he was a... He was a smashing old bugger. He was good to all the youngsters. And the point is, of course, you've got to remember that in the main, we were youngsters. When I mentioned about Alf Dietz, by the way, the only reason that Alf Dietz was that he was older, actually he had been in the Marines. But he became allergic to khaki. So they transferred him into the Navy. No, this chief petty officer, he was a nice old fella, and he didn't show any sort of preference, and he didn't shout. He just had this authoritative way of, you know, explaining something, and I had no complaints about that. In fact, you know, I mean, I've heard tales of other people and people have spoken about their experiences at Whale Island at the gunnery school at Portsmouth and that, and where everything was done at a double and order. But we never had nothing like that at Ganges. It was civilised.